It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The state budget passed earlier this month with mixed news on education funding.
The governor and the legislature agreed to increase special education reimbursements, which school leaders have been calling for.
But there wasn't a general increase for school funding in spite of a $4 billion budget surplus.
That comes as some federal school funding programs were blocked by the Trump administration at the beginning of the month.
The state's top elected education official joins us now for a look at funding and other issues facing Wisconsin schools. Jill Underley is the state superintendent of public instruction. Superintendent Underley, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, good morning.
Before we get to the state budget, I want to start with the breaking news yesterday. Wisconsin joining this federal lawsuit after some funds that were supposed to be dispersed to schools on July 1st were blocked by the Trump administration on June 30th. What are those funds? What is the impact on schools if that money isn't coming?
Right. Well, these were funds that were already approved by Congress. And we heard in March, as you said, in 2025, that the Trump administration said we're going to get the funding, but these are funds that impact after-school programs, before-school programs, and summer school care.
What are you hearing from school leaders about this abrupt change and indefinite pause on that funding?
Well, that's the issue, right? Because when we had the green light a few months ago, our schools had already then proceeded to budget these dollars into the next school year. Because, again, Congress had appropriated them. And now they're left trying to figure out how to fund those programs. And so it's going to impact kids.
Now, turning to the state budget, first of all, let's start with the positives that school leaders are pointing out. The increase in special education reimbursement from the state. It's a little complicated. There's a formula there. What is that special education reimbursement? Why is it important to local districts?
Yeah, so the special education, that's an area that, you know, we've got some progress. So as I said, when the budget deal was announced, there's progress we're celebrating around special education, but there's more work to be done. So as it is, school districts currently were funded 30% reimbursed, I should say, on their expenses for special education, and the state budget increased that to 45% reimbursement. So that's, you know, good news. I mean, that's progress in the right direction. So it will give school districts a little bit more relief when it comes to being able to get some reimbursement for those expenses.
On the other hand, no increase in general aid for schools. And I know a lot of school superintendents and school boards have been hoping for more of that. After an earlier version of a budget plan for the Joint Finance Committee came out, you were critical of a lack of that kind of general funding increase. What do you make of this this compromise budget between the governor and Republican leaders that didn't really boost that?
Yeah, so as you said, you know, schools didn't get an increase. This is the first time they've got zero increase in new dollars since 2010. So even with the offset of that small bump in special education, it's not going to be enough to cover the gap that exists between what schools need to operate and what schools are receiving in aid. So I think the message for me here is that citizens need to know that our school districts, our school boards, and our superintendents, this is not a problem that they created, and they're going to have to make some tough decisions, you know, about programming, hiring staff, and especially when you couple that with the uncertainty at the federal level with funding. So again, you know, times are really tough for our local public school districts, and I just hope our citizens understand that this was not something that they created, and our school districts are going to have to make some tough decisions.
Is it likely, do you think, that school districts are going to turn toward property taxes, going to referendums, taking advantage of the so-called 400-year partial veto from Governor Evers to be able to nudge up some of the property tax outlays?
Well, that's the issue that the local school districts are going to have to struggle with. If they're not getting the aid from the state, they're going to have to rely on local property taxes to make that up. And really, it's whether our communities, our local school districts and the voters or the property tax owners, I should say, what type of appetite they have, you know, for having to constantly increase their local taxes is when the responsibility for funding our public schools should be coming from the state.
as you mentioned, we're just a few weeks out from a new school year. The budget happened just a little bit behind schedule, but it was a little behind schedule. And this federal news now came out midsummer. Are you hearing from districts a sense of, hey, we're kind of scrambling here, getting these pieces into place as, you know, we're getting ready to open the doors to students?
Yeah, you know, ever since really COVID, I mean, we've been struggling with a lot of these different issues. School districts have really struggled for resources, financial resources especially. But, you know, when you look at other areas where we've struggled, you know, with attracting and retaining teachers, our school districts have been in these emergency modes for some time. And we need to, as a state, and I think as a, you know, population of voters, really just stand up and say, this is what's really important to us. Public education is really important to the state of Wisconsin. We need to have more of a, you know, much more investment in it. So our school district leaders shouldn't have to struggle, because ultimately this is impacting the services to kids. It's impacting public education that our kids are receiving. And when you're not getting increases to aid, I mean, that's going to impact the type of programs and the type of opportunities our kids are receiving.
We're talking to Jill Underlee, superintendent of the State Department of Public Instruction, about the new school year, the state budget, and more. Superintendent Underlee, a couple other budget points. Student mental health funding of $30 million came through in that budget. There were calls for as much as $300 million. I think that was in the governor's plan. What do you see that student mental health funding going toward, and is it enough?
It's not enough, but, you know, it's going to continue to help, you know, in areas that we've been able to support, you know, such as, you know, anti-bullying programs, peer-to-peer mentoring, potentially professional development for teachers. There's different ways local school districts could use it. But when we look at a rise, you know, in anxiety and depression and mental health issues that we've seen as a result of our youth mental health survey, we know that there is a dire need for programming. And so that's why we had, you know, proposed such a, you know, such a large amount, but it's really meant to help kids who are struggling, because ultimately we want to make sure kids are healthy. We want to make sure that the teachers are also healthy so that, you know, they can be successful. Ultimately, let's like address the problems now when kids are young, so that they can grow into being healthy adults and productive citizens.
And the budget finally included increases to the state's Office of School Safety. That was created back in 2018 after a mass shooting in Florida. Of course, we had the tragic Abundant Life shooting here in Wisconsin. What do you see as priorities for school safety?
Well, that's just part of it, right? Mental health, belonging, making sure every child feels safe in their school. And a big piece of that is belonging, and mental health is really the umbrella under which belonging fits. And so when we talk about school safety, we want to make sure every kid feels seen and feels safe in their schools. And that's what that funding helps do, helps provide.
Moving away from the particulars of the budget, we still see some after effects on reading and math scores since the pandemic. Where do you see Wisconsin schools when it comes to coming back from that those difficult years of education?
Well, that's just it. You know, we're 5 years out now, and we know that making sure our kids can read is the most important thing we do in early childhood education. And my administration and, you know, we've been a champion of this work since I took office. I'm excited to see it continue to move forward. Our school districts have been real champions in this as well. You know, they've been working on training and implementing the required early literacy screener. And the budget delivered on the promise to help offset those costs for evidence-based reading reform. So I'm really proud of the work that our school districts have been doing, and I'm proud of the work we've been doing here at the agency. We've collected a first round of costs from schools, and so we are hoping to reimburse our school districts. You know, as we shared earlier, you know, they're struggling for revenue, so this will be a good way to reimburse them for some of the expenses they've incurred already.
A problem that goes back way before COVID, the outcomes gap between Black and white students in things like math and reading scores, other educational outcomes in the state. Been around for a long time. As we go into a new school year, what do you see out there that could move the needle?
Well, that's just it. It shouldn't be completely on the school districts to solve these. I mean, when you look at struggling students in different areas like literacy and math, or even in mental health, I mean, we really need to look at the impact that poverty has on student outcomes. And so when we invest in the areas that we know work, like literacy, math, in the school districts that need the most resources, that's the other piece. We look at other things like meals, making sure kids have access to healthy breakfast and lunch options at low or no cost. These are the we know early childhood education, high quality childcare. We know that these are the solutions. Like we know these things work, and these are the programs we need to be investing in so that we know over the course of a child's life that if they have these, you know, programs and they have access to these programs, they're going to grow up to be healthy. They're going to grow up to be ready for school, and their academic outcomes are going to be greater.
In our last few moments, we saw adjustments in proficiency standards on our key standardized tests in the state. When standardized test season rolls around in Wisconsin, what do you say to parents in particular about how to read the results when they come out for their kids and for their districts?
Well, these measures are just really a moment in time, right? You know, it's just one piece of the bigger, you know, report card or scorecard for how our kids are doing and how our schools are performing. And so, you know, it's an area that we can look at, areas that we can identify where there needs to be growth. And our scores have been equated to the old cuts, so it's really a not an issue at this moment. We can find those crosswalks at the DPI.
Superintendent Underley, thanks for joining us.
You bet, Rob. Thanks very much.
That's Jill Underley, State Superintendent of Public Instruction. She joined us for a look at the new state budget and other big issues facing schools around Wisconsin.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, in the remote mountains of Chile, a UW-Madison physicist has a key role in bringing a powerful telescope online.
We can see asteroids moving throughout our solar system. We can see stars pulsating throughout the Milky Way. We can see stars exploding in other galaxies.
The capabilities of the Rubin Observatory, that's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The first images from the Rubin Observatory Telescope are live. It's named after U.S. astronomer Vera Rubin and set in the remote mountains of Chile, giving astronomers an eye to the cosmos never seen before.
This is how the control room sounded when the telescope provided the first images of distant galaxies last month.
We just acquired the greatest image in the history of astronomy. Congratulations.
A UW-Madison cosmologist had a key role in developing the telescope, which will gather more astronomical data in its first year than all the other optical telescopes in history combined.
Keith Bechtel is an associate professor in the Department of Physics and serves in a leadership role as the Rubin Observatory's system verification and validation scientist. Keith, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
You were in the room when the Rubin Observatory went live, and you had been working on this project for nearly a decade. What was that feeling like in the moment?
It was amazing to see the first images. At that moment, I was actually incredibly focused because I was helping to decide what the first target would be, and we wanted to make sure that we were pointing in the right spot of the sky. And then when we saw the first images, we knew that the telescope was very close to being in focus. It was probably about a millimeter within being in focus. And that was a huge achievement for the team. And within a few exposures, we were basically in a rough focus and alignment and could start the on-sky engineering tests.
Wow. What were those images like, you know, as you saw them coming in? Can you talk about the colors and what you're seeing?
So each individual exposure is taken with a single range of wavelength. And so we don't get color from an individual image.
Okay.
The way that we're able to reconstruct the colors is that we have multiple filters. We have six different filters that span from the near ultraviolet to the near infrared, including a little bit of range outside of what humans can see. And that allows us to basically create full color images of the night sky when we combine the observations and the multiple filters.
And you call what this telescope is doing a cosmic movie. What do you mean by that?
It's a cosmic movie because over the course of 10 years, we will take 2.5 million images of the night sky. And Rubin Observatory has been specifically designed to scan the night sky faster than any other facility before. We take something like 800 to 1,000 images every night. And each individual image covers a wide region of the sky, about 45 times the size of the full moon. And so over the course of the night, we're constantly scanning the night sky. It's kind of a point and shoot with a very, very large digital camera, the largest digital camera ever made. And by doing this relentless survey over 10 years, we're able to cover basically the full sky visible from Chile every three nights. And then that means that we can come back to each part of the sky. Each part of the sky will be imaged something like about 800 times over the course of 10 years. And what that allows us to do is bring the night sky to life in the sense that we see everything that moves, we see everything that changes, we can see asteroids moving throughout our solar system, we can see stars pulsating throughout the Milky Way, we can see stars exploding in other galaxies.
I can't fathom the amount of computing power you have to do that.
It's enormous. The total volume of data that will be collected is comparable to all of written language over all of human history in all languages. It's about 500 petabytes of data that will be generated.
I'm not even clear about that word. not something we use day to day in describing the size of something.
Yeah. One way to think about it is that every single day we would fill up about 20 high-end laptops worth of data, about 20 terabytes every day.
Okay.
And then that just continues to amass. And then as we process the data, we create a whole suite of data products that will help scientists around the world make sense of the data and turn it into knowledge and new scientific discoveries.
Turning into knowledge and scientific discoveries, what are some of the big questions you're trying to answer with the help of this telescope and the images?
The science case for Rubin Observatory is extremely broad. It extends all the way from objects in our own solar system, some of them which pass by the orbit of the Earth, and extends all the way to understanding the formation of the Milky Way, understanding how galaxies have evolved over more than 10 billion years of cosmic history. And we even hope to learn a little bit about how the universe began and what were the initial conditions that created the seeds that galaxies could form.
Like dark matter, dark energy?
Dark matter and dark energy are some of the topics that I'm personally most excited about. The dark matter and dark energy, they collectively make up about 95% of the matter and energy in the universe today, but they're invisible and they point to new physics beyond our current models. So it's these very deep, profound questions, and Rubin Observatory gives us a chance to approach those.
So will UW students be able to benefit from this telescope or the power of the images coming back?
Absolutely. So I have multiple students in my research group right now at Wisconsin who have participated in the commissioning of Rubin Observatory, are looking at the data now and starting to write some of the first papers with the Rubin data. So it's an extremely exciting time. I see one of my primary roles as an educator in helping to train the next generation of scientists and engineers who will be able to continue building these kinds of transformative projects.
You were there bringing this telescope online, and you're a system verification and validation scientist on this project. So what role do you have in the Rubin Observatory?
My role is to help to gather the evidence that shows that the camera, the telescope, the data management system are all working together as a single integrated observatory. What that means practically is that over almost the past 10 years, I've helped to envision what are the types of tests that we would need to do both before we go on, you know, start taking images of the night sky, everything that we would need to do to prepare. And then once we're at this stage of the on-sky engineering, what are all the tests that we need to do? So we've been practicing, we've been rehearsing, we've been thinking through all of the what-ifs and different scenarios, how we would respond to different types of situations. And it even comes down to the details of, you know, who's going to be on shift and, you know, where they need to be at the right time. So it's included all of those different aspects of both the scientific vision, but also the practical day-to-day planning.
We're talking with UW-Madison physicist Keith Bechtel, who has had a prominent role in the Vera Rubin Observatory in Chile, coming online in recent days. And this observatory is said to give scientists a view into the cosmos like never before. Can you talk about the multiple countries working together, scientists from all over building the telescope, and why also it's located in Chile, in South America?
That's right. So there have been thousands of scientists around the world that have helped to develop the science case for Rubin Observatory. Part of the reason why it was identified as the highest priority project for ground-based astronomy in the 2010 Astronomical Decadal Survey was that it has such a broad science portfolio that extends the solar system, the galaxy, questions about the overall evolution of the universe over cosmic time. In addition, we have a team of over 1,000 scientists and engineers who have been directly contributing to the construction of the observatory. The first ideas of the project started forming in 1997, 1998 timeframe. So it's been multiple decades. And there are over 30 countries that are directly contributing to the commissioning and the construction project, and more countries that are involved in the operations. Part of the reason why the Rubin Observatory is located in Chile is that it's one of the best places in the world for doing astronomy. It's located in the Andes Mountains at an elevation of around 8,000 feet, so you try to get above as much of the atmosphere as possible. It's an extremely dry site located in the Atacama Desert, so you get many clear nights, not very many clouds. And it's in a dark sky sanctuary. It's been protected by the Chilean people as a dedicated place for admiring the beauty of the night sky. And the Chilean people have been extremely supportive of astronomy. When you're in La Serena and talk to people on the street, they know they know about these projects and they're excited about it. They're extremely supportive. And it's been just a joy to work there with scientists and engineers from all over the world. I've learned so much.
A protected dark sky, how important is that for scientists and the work you're doing?
We want to be in as dark a location as possible. And this particular location, if you can imagine, you fly into Santiago and then you fly about an hour north to La Serena, and then it's about a two-hour drive up into the mountains. So it's quite a remote location on the ridge, and it's beautiful, and it really, I mean, I think it really helps you to connect with nature and appreciate that there are places in the world that have this kind of protection that allow us to do the work that we do.
You're so interested in dark matter. What are some of the other big questions at stake here?
So I think everyone should be invested in Rubin Observatory in the sense that we are creating an inventory of our solar system. There'll be about 5 million asteroids and other objects in our solar system that are studied by Rubin Observatory. That's a significant increase from the about 1 million that are known now. Even just in the first nights of observations, we discovered over 2,000 new objects in our solar system. And one of the reasons why we're interested in doing this is that we'd like to have an inventory of all the objects that potentially pass near the orbit of the Earth so that we would potentially have a little bit of advance warning if we found that one of them was going to pass close to us.
Thousands of new objects. I mean, that must be just so exciting as a scientist when you're not seeing one or two new things, but in the thousands of new things, it's like a whole new sky.
That's right. Rubin Observatory is really changing the way that we think about doing astronomy, or it's part of this larger evolution in the sense that it used to be that astronomers would write proposals and they'd, you know, they go to a telescope and they observe their specific target and they'd go back, you know, to their university and do their data analysis. Mm-hmm. The new model is that we map the entire sky, we create this vast digital database, and then thousands of scientists around the world can basically write a database query to get the subset of data that they need. We've created tools that scientists can log online from anywhere in the world and be able to basically bring their analysis tools to the data working in the cloud. And what that does is that it not only makes the data available, but it makes a lot of the tools for doing the science more broadly available.
Hmm. And it sounds like it's a shared open effort in order to be able to look at the data, work with the data. And I would imagine that's so important, too, to learn new things.
We want to encourage as many creative new ideas as possible.
One of the images from the Rubin telescope shows the Virgo cluster. What have you learned about the Virgo cluster?
The Virgo cluster, it's the closest large assembly of galaxies to our Milky Way. It's over 1,000 galaxies, and it's actually, you know, three different large groups of galaxies that are all kind of merging together. So it's part of this network of what we call the large-scale structure of the universe. It's one of these nodes where you see many galaxies all clustered together. We took these images of the Virgo cluster, and we were in the observatory, in the control room, and when we started seeing these images coming in, there were moments when it was just completely quiet. I mean, we're all, you know, professional scientists, professional engineers, but there were moments that were just breathtaking. We could see just this incredible detail of the galaxies. We could see low surface brightness features, basically the halo of stars extending far beyond the part of the galaxy that you can normally see. And as we started assembling these images into what we call sort of a deep coad, a deep stack of all the images to get the full information and the full color, we could see that most of the galaxies in this region, they're probably over the light has been traveling over 5 billion years to reach us. We're basically seeing the light from galaxies before the sun and the earth formed in our solar system. So we're seeing this enormous breadth of cosmic history that's kind of in the background of the Virgo cluster. And then in the foreground, we could see thousands of solar system objects. We took these images over a series of nights, and we took it in almost kind of a cinematic mode where we took hundreds of individual visits within a period of a few hours. And we could, in that time, kind of create this movie and see the objects in our solar system, like literally, you know, tracking across. And someone described it as the asteroids are sort of photo bombings, so to speak, all the galaxies in the background. So part of our goal for taking this data is that we really wanted to tell the story of the enormous range of science that could be pursued within a single data set.
Mm. Another image is the Trifidon Lagoon Nebula, and wondering why are these images significant? And from what I understand, you can see the Lagoon Nebula with binoculars. Like, why do you need such a huge, powerful telescope?
So what we were trying to do with the images of the Trifidon Lagoon is we were trying to take a cross-section through the plane of our galaxy so that you could really start to see the structure of our galaxy. And this is a region that we picked specifically because it's so beautiful. We wanted to pull out the level of detail that you could see with such a high resolution camera. We wanted to bring out the colors that you could see that reflect regions where new stars are being formed, where the light from the stars is reflecting off of gas and dust in our Milky Way. And I think what you really see in the Rubin images is just the number of stars is unbelievable. We knew that we were going to see the bright nebulae themselves, the Trifidon Lagoon Nebula. But I think what really struck me was the amount of detail in the dust lanes, the sheer number of stars, the range of colors of the stars, just the amount of information content in the images was just staggering. And we could see so much more than just the nebulae themselves. And I think for me, that was one of the most exciting parts.
As we go here, you've been working toward this launch project for years now. How will your research and teaching change at this juncture as this, you know, powerful telescope is now up and running?
For the next several years, I really hope to work closely with students and postdocs here at UW-Madison on extracting as much information as we can from the images, working with collaborators around the world. We are just at the start of this 10-year survey, and the scientific potential for discovery is just enormous. At the same time, I also feel like I'm at an intellectual state where I've been thinking about this project so intensely, and I've gained so much experience seeing how one of these enormous projects come together that I'm already starting to think about, you know, what do we want to do next? Like, what are the next really exciting options? So I guess I see this as a starting point rather than a conclusion.
Keith, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this discovery and the work of the Rubin Observatory.
Thanks so much for having me.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Keith Bechtel is an associate professor in the Department of Physics at UW-Madison studying matter, energy, space, and time. Bechtel serves in a leadership role with the Rubin Observatory, which recently launched a telescope with the largest digital camera on Earth.
Still ahead, a Rib Mountain man breaks the record for the fastest paddle of the Wisconsin River, doing it on very little rest.
So that was part of my motivation to not sleep because, you know, as soon as you stop on shore, the record pace starts to catch up to you. So if you're not moving down the river, you're losing your lead.
3 days, hundreds of miles, that journey is next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Wisconsin kayaker has smashed a 30-year speed record for solo paddling the entire Wisconsin River, roughly 430 miles from Land O'Lakes to Prairie du Chien.
Rib Mountain resident Andy Nevitt raced through the state along Wisconsin's main waterway. Over Memorial Day weekend, he completed the journey in 3 days, 20 hours and 45 minutes, shattering the previous record set in 1995 by over 5 hours.
We're catching up now with Andy Nevitt to talk about his record-setting experience for the fastest solo paddle down the Wisconsin River. Andy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Kate.
Rivers, they are wild, they're beautiful, but they can also be so deadly. And I'm wondering, as we start out, do you have reflections on the Guadalupe River tragedy in Texas Hill Country?
Well, you're absolutely right. I think that there is a power that's harnessed, or a potential power that rivers have, or even, you know, lakes and water in general. And the tragedy that's unfolded on the Guadalupe River is unfortunately a really tragic showcasing of what can happen when you're susceptible to the power that it can unleash. And it's really sad to see. And my thoughts go out to the families that are affected by that. It's just awful to see. Mm-hmm.
Turning to your journey, running the entire Wisconsin River, and you said you slept only about 5 hours throughout the nearly 4-day paddle. Where did you find the energy to keep going?
It was kind of a combination. You know, there's different motivating factors. You know, I've gone and done races where sleep is not easily come by. With this, my motivation was really, you know, I wanted to break the record. And I knew that my pace was out in front of the record. I knew I had, you know, somewhere between a 2 and an 8 hour lead throughout the attempt over the record pace. So that was part of my motivation to not sleep, because, you know, as soon as you stop on shore, the record pace starts to catch up to you. So if you're not moving down the river, you're losing your lead. So that was part of it. And part, the other part was I knew a lot of people were following. There's a little bit of pressure on myself. And I think that, you know, at first it was sort of anxiety producing, but over time I kind of used it as a source of motivation along the way. So.
I was reading about the record tracking site that was, I would imagine, was also following you, Fastest Known Paddle, and describing how you went through waist-deep mud and these high winds and these waves and the multiple sets of rapids and, of course, as you know, the sleep deprivation. What was the hardest of these to push through?
I think that, you know, the challenges were kind of compounded just by being so fatigued. But I would say that the hardest challenge was paddling at night in the fog, not only because it was dark and I was tired, but after a while, the sleep deprivation kind of starts playing tricks on your mind and you start maybe seeing things. Like if you see a patch of fog on the river in the dark, sometimes it can kind of look like a giant tree. And sometimes the fog actually is a tree and it's very mentally fatiguing, very taxing to have that uncertainty. So I would say that was the biggest challenge. There were rapids and there were lake crossings that were pretty choppy and, you know, that kind of tossed me around a little bit. But I think the nighttime paddling through the fog was what wore me down the most.
Did it feel like you would get disoriented as to where you were?
Yeah, there was a place further down the river on the lower Wisconsin, as I was approaching Muscadet, the town of Muscadet, it had just gotten dark. I think it was around 10 p.m., 10 or 11. And that was really the first time where I started to experience some sleep deprived, I wouldn't call it hallucinations, but just sort of disorganized thinking. I was kind of unable to concentrate. My vision wasn't able to focus on an object in front of me. That was really the first time. So when I arrived in Muscadet, I sort of demanded some time to sleep from my wife, my ground support. And I slept for about 90 minutes there, and it seemed to help, at least for a short while.
So your wife served as your support captain and driving along the river through the journey. Can you talk more about her role in this attempt?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been doing this kind of ultra distance racing stuff for maybe 6 years or so. And for the most part, she's been my ground support for all of these long races that I do. So it's been a learning process for me, you know, as far as my gear and learning about myself and my endurance abilities. And it's also been a learning process for her. And I think we've gotten to a point here within the last year or two where we really kind of click and everything kind of falls in nicely. You know, she kind of understands how my mentality changes along the way. Sometimes I can, you know, you get fatigued and you start to not be able to communicate the way you want. You might get a little grumpy and things like that. And she does a really good job about keeping me centered and keeping me focused. So, and also she does a great job with the, you know, the gear. A lot of the job is to swap out hydration packs and have batteries charged and things like that. And she's always been on top of it really well, especially during this attempt.
We're talking about a new record speed for solo paddling the entire Wisconsin River, and Andy Nevitt holds it. Andy, you know, Wisconsin River, 430 miles long, travels right through a number of major cities like Wausau and Prairie du Chien. What parts of the river stood out to you on the journey? Because you had so much different scenery also to look at.
Yeah, that's one of the unique things about the Wisconsin River is that it provides a complete variety of different situations. You know, you've got 30 miles of the headwaters, you know, from its source in Lac Vieux d'Azur all the way to near Eagle River, where it feels like you're paddling on a creek. You know, there are beaver dams and there are trees down and there's twists and turns in the river. It really feels like, am I really on the Wisconsin River? You know, if you know what the Wisconsin River looks like at the tail end, it doesn't look anything like what it looks like way up north. But yeah, you've got lake crossings and rapids and all sorts of stuff. And, you know, a lot of people along the way are probably really familiar with their own local section. Like if you talk to somebody who lived near Wausau, they'd probably tell you about what the Wisconsin River looks like in Wausau, you know, Lake Wausau and the nearby stretches of river. The people up north know it as the headwaters. You know, it is kind of neat to paddle down the full length, and you kind of, I don't know, string a thread through the entire river and you connect all of those communities along the way.
Hmm.
It's a pretty neat experience. Something that I'd like to do it again, maybe a little bit more casual pace.
Well, I was just going to say, it's not like you could stop and talk with people along the way. I mean, you couldn't hold any conversations and
there were people who came out, and it was another source of motivation where people that would come out as I was portaging around the dams. There's 26 dams along the way. I met, I don't know how many people in communities along the way, just chatting with them about, you know, as I was walking from the upriver side to the downriver side of the dam, got to talk to a lot of people along the way. And it was a really neat experience.
So can you talk more about the gear you brought for this and how it might compare to, you know, typical kayak equipment?
Sure, yeah. So the kayak that I used it's called a Stellar Falcon, and it's a kind of a subtype of kayak called a surf ski. And these surf skis were sort of born as ocean kayaks, and they're actually used for ocean lifeguards used to use them as rescue craft for people who are trapped out in the surf. And over time, especially within the last, I don't know, I'd say probably 15 or 20 years, they've been used in downriver racing, and people kind of outfit them differently to accommodate for river use. And they're nice and fast, and they're easy to get in and out. They're sort of a sit on top. They're almost like an open top kayak. But it's the one that I use is just shy of 20 feet long and under 19 inches wide. So long and skinny. And it's you sacrifice a lot of stability for its speed. You get used to it after a while. I used something called a wing paddle. It's sort of a special paddle that's sort of spoon shaped, and it gives you a little bit more purchase on the water, and it's built for efficiency. That's mainly what I use as far as the equipment goes. I didn't bring much, you know, as in the way of trail mix or a six pack.
I was going to ask about snacks. Yeah. You know, I'm very interested in snacks.
Water is the heaviest thing. If you bring a water pack or something like that, that's the heaviest thing that you can add to the boat. It's, you know, it can make your kayak weigh more pretty quickly. So, and snacks and everything there's not a lot of extra room. So I actually used an endurance powder in my hydration pack. It's from a company called Infinite Nutrition out of, I think, Ohio. So most of my calories came straight from the water that I was drinking. And then I would also supplement that with, I kind of have a penchant for, I like these dehydrated mango strips. So I'll keep a little Ziploc bag of mango strips in my pocket, in my life vest. And then, you know, other little things, you have these little Stinger waffle cookies that are high calorie, and mainly that's the real challenge. You know, I'm not bringing things for taste. I'm bringing things for their calorie content.
There are thousands of kayakers and paddlers in Wisconsin. What sets Wisconsin's paddle community apart from others, do you think?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the upper Midwest is kind of a growing area for, well, paddle racing in particular. Wisconsin paddling, the community is fantastic just because of the variety of water that we have. I mean, Wisconsin, especially, you know, the central part of Wisconsin and the north part are just full of great lakes and, you know, waterways, rivers that range from as large as the Wisconsin River down to smaller ones. And I think there's the paddling community in Wisconsin does a great job of contributing to the organizations that support and protect the waterways. And they really get out and put full use to the resources that we have.
Do you remember your first paddle?
My very first paddle.
Yeah.
I think it was at a summer camp when I was a kid. I was probably 8 or 9 years old. I think it was in Whitewater, Wisconsin. I can't remember the name of the camp, but that was the first time that I think I went out for a paddle.
Did it leave an impression on you, or was there a particular time where you said, this is really for me?
There was, and that came much later. After I finished my anesthesia program, we were living in La Crosse at the time, and my in-laws, my wife's parents, got me a 10-foot recreational kayak, something that you might pick up at the local department store as a Christmas present. And I remember the following spring, it's probably late April or early May, I finally got it out on the water. And it was at Goose Island in La Crosse. I put it out on the water and started paddling it around. And this memory came back from hearing about this crazy ultra-distance race that goes across the state of Missouri. It's 340 miles. This memory came back, and I thought about that. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to enter that race. You know, one way or another, I'm gonna get to the finish line there. And that was really the thing that started it all.
All right, now's the time to declare it. Is there a paddle challenge you have your eye on next?
I don't think so. There's nothing that comes to mind. A lot of people ask me about doing the Mississippi River. That seems to be the next level up, which is a huge challenge. And I don't think that's something that I'm interested in now, and probably not ever. It's just such a time commitment, and with my family obligations and responsibilities, it's something that I definitely can't cut out from my time. So I think probably what I'll do in the near future is just go back to my racing. You know, there's long distance races in Minnesota and Missouri, and just around the Midwest that I'll probably go back to participating in. So I'd like to do a little bit more team racing. I've done a lot of solo racing over the past couple of years, and it'd be nice to partner up with some other people to do these races.
Well, Andy, all the best to you. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you, Kate. I appreciate it.
And that is Andy Nevitt. He is a nurse anesthetist from Rib Mountain, recently broke the fastest record for paddling the entire Wisconsin River, doing it in just 3 days, 20 hours, and 45 minutes. Go, Andy.
Kids are riding bikes less than they used to, according to national surveys. One of the big reasons may be the way we've designed our roads in our towns and cities.
Next week on the show, we'll find out how communities around Wisconsin are trying to make it safer and easier for kids to ride their Huffies to school and elsewhere.
And we want to hear from you. If you're one of the young people we're talking about, do you ride your bike? Do you feel safe when you do? What would make your neighborhood more bike-friendly for you? If you're a parent, we'd love to hear your perspective, too.
Or if you see obstacles or opportunities for kids biking in your community, we'd love to hear about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
We'll be right back. Wisconsin Today. Producers include Colleen Leahy, Mackenzie Crummy, and Royce Podesla. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.